You're listening to a CarCast digital audio recording of the Charlottesville Area Association of Realtors general membership meeting from Thursday, February 1st, 2007. These meetings are open to all car members. We gather at the Doubletree Hotel in Charlottesville on the first Thursday of each month at 8:15 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to go ahead and get started. First thing we'd like to do today is approval of the minutes of the last meeting. The minutes should be on the bottom of your agenda. Take a moment to look them over, and then if I could have a motion. Is there a second? Second? All in favor say aye. Opposed, the same? Motion is carried. Thank you. Next order of the business is really the fun part. I'm pleased to recognize our sponsor today, which is Churchill Homes. And Greg Slater is going to be speaking to us, but while he's coming forward, I'd just like to tell you that, if you don't know, when we were approached about purchasing the K-Tech house we needed to and turning it into a workforce housing home, we had to have some place to get it on the lot, et cetera, and Churchill immediately, Josh and Slick, stepped forward and immediately joined us in that effort. So now we have the house on a lot in Scottsville. They're finishing it up, and we'll be able to put it on the market fairly soon. So thank both of you for your efforts, and Greg, thanks for coming.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Greg Slater. I'm the Director of Sales and Marketing for Churchill Homes. I want to thank CAR for the opportunity to be able to sponsor this meeting. And we're very excited to be a part of the K-Tech project. Affordable housing is an issue that we take very seriously and are very concerned with. So we're glad to be involved with the K-Tech project, as well as starting construction on what we think are the first proffered affordable units coming to the real estate market this year, which will be located Avon Park. So if you have buyers that may fit into the workforce housing criteria and you want to learn more about this project or other opportunities where there will be some affordable housing coming to the marketplace in the new construction world, all you have to do is contact us. We'll be happy to share that with you. We wanted to sponsor this meeting this morning just to let you know a little bit more about us. We recognize the market has changed over the last 12 months, and we're working hard to create a process to make the home buying experience very customer service oriented before, during, and after the sale. And we're doing that in several ways. One of the ways we're doing it in our new communities is building model homes and keeping them staffed with Churchill Home team members. So when you're showing property that may not be finished, there's something there to show you what the finish looks like, as well as have someone there to answer your questions and help you assist your buyers. Josh has also assembled a team at Churchill Homes to make the process much better. We have the sales staff, which is working the models. He's got some of the best project managers in the business. We have an interior coordinator who helps your buyers all the way through the process of making their selections and making the home their own. And we also have a warranty manager who reports directly to Josh every week to make sure we're dealing with those items that come up after closing. We have an office downtown adjacent to the new ACAC that was just built on Monticello Avenue with a residential condo that's been converted into a design center, so your clients can come there to see the finishings as well and use this vehicle to make their selections and get the house the way they want it. But most importantly, I think what we're doing, Josh has made himself completely available to me in the sales process. If you're interested in one of our homes or one of our communities and the spec inventory is not a fit for your client, call us up, we'll bring you in, we'll sit down with your client, and we will customize our home plans to meet their needs and try to get them exactly what they want. So if there's any way we can help you going forward, just give us a call. Thanks. We have two door prizes. The first, this is a goodie bag from Churchill Homes. We give this to our homeowners and the agents who sell our houses. And the winner is Cole Ure. Can we give that to him? Yeah, we got another one. Is that the second one? The second prize is a $150 gift certificate. If you didn't know, you can go to the downtown mall now and buy a gift certificate that's good across all the participating businesses on the mall, and that information is in here. And the winner is Stephen Suddeth.
Thank you, Greg, Josh, Churchill Holmes. We appreciate it. My remarks will be brief, but I just wanted to mention briefly this morning about next week's legislative conference and Realtor on the Hill Day. First of all, how many people went to Realtor on the Hill last year, just by a show of hands? We had a great group last year, and if you're thinking about going, wondering what it's like, talk to any of these people and see what they think about it. But it's a lot of fun, and it's also a very worthwhile thing to do. It's a good way to communicate with our representatives, let them know what we're thinking, and have some input into the whole process. And this is going to be an important year. There's a lot of bills that are being considered that do affect us. Benton's going to talk about some of that later. And so I think it will be worth your time. If you have any questions, you can talk to anybody at Carr or Dave, and it's free. It doesn't cost to go to the day on the Hill. If you choose to go to the rest of the conference, there is obviously a registration fee for that. You can go to the conference for get a one-day registration or register for the entire conference. So I just look forward to seeing you next week at Day on the Hill. And now I'd like to ask Linda Broadbent to come forward and introduce our speaker for the day. I understand we'll hear more about legislative and legal issues that affect us this year. Linda?
Good morning, everyone. Your Education and Risk Management Committee is delighted to have Larry McIlwain with us this morning. I was reading Larry's bio the other night, and I thought I've known Larry pretty well for many years. Larry started his legal practice here in Charlottesville in 1976, and most of us know that he's an undergraduate of University of Virginia and that he went to Boston College to get his law degree, and he's been extremely active in the profession in a broad facet of litigation and real estate work and so forth. So we know him in a lot of ways, also for his charitable work. But in looking at his bio, I saw that he graduated from a high school in Hawaii, and I thought, whoa, what a place to have your high school prom. So that I didn't know about Larry. But we really are pleased to have Larry here this morning. Many of you work with Larry in a variety of real estate issues, and he is active in our community as well as the state in our profession. So it's very good to have Larry here. And this morning, he's going to talk to us about some legal disputes, recurring issues and disputes that he sees in his practice, as well as some of the proposed legislation in the General Assembly that will impact our profession. So we're very happy to have Larry with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a real treat to be here and see so many of my friends in one place at one time. It really is to just touch base. It's rewarding after 35 years in town to have built up the friendship and professional relationships that we have in the room today. So thank you for the opportunity, and thank you, Linda, for having me. I was asked to just kind of informally go over what I see as trends out there in the marketplace at this particular time. In order to do that, I was musing, and last October, there appeared in the Washington Post an article that caught my attention. A friend of mine is the chief counsel for NV Homes, which is the parent corporation for a couple of very large builders, Ryan being among them. And in this particular article, he was quoted as citing the fact that in the third quarter of the year 2006, 39% of the contracts that had gotten written for his corporation's homes were either breached or for some other reason there was a failure to close. So you can imagine the impact upon a developer of the size that we're talking about when literally 40% of the contracts are going south. Big problems, and when that happens, fingers start to point. And they point in every direction. They're going to point at legal counsel, but they're also going to point at real estate agents. And one of the things that I haven't seen this case yet, but I'm waiting for it to happen because I've seen way too much of this in this local community. At least in Northern Virginia, when you sign contracts, they will have significant deposits that are put down on the purchase of the homes. Down here, I have frequently seen $500 deposits, $1,000 deposits, something like that. I'm waiting on the multi, $800,000 contract that has a deposit of only $500 or $1,000 in it, and the buyer just walks away, breaches the contract. And the seller is left holding the bag, and he can't sell the house for a long, long time, and his damages mount up. And what's he doing? He's looking for an opportunity to cut his damages. And where's he going to look? One of the places I think he's going to look is at the real estate agent. He said, you're a professional. I listed it with you. You advised me. The contract offer came in. It had this ridiculously low deposit. These people have now gone south. I'm suffering damages to a large extent on a daily basis. I think you committed malpractice, and I'm coming after you. Now, that case has not happened yet in the state of Virginia. But as soon as sure as I'm standing here, I think that case is going to happen. And I would not want to be in the witness stand as the real estate agent having to answer why I took a $500 deposit on a couple hundred thousand dollar property. So that perhaps is the biggest niche that I see that needs to be addressed locally. I think you also, from that point of view, need to know what you might be facing if something like that comes down. It's the same as the buyer who is breached. What damages does the seller incur? Well, obviously, you're going to sell the house presumably at a later time, and there's going to be a measure of a loss in the purchase price itself. Typically, we've got you'll see when the slowdown occurs, and that's when the breaches start to happen. You have a decrease in the housing in the prices, so you're going to sell it at a later date for a lower amount of money. So you're going to lose money, and you're also going to lose, and people forget about this, the loss of the use of the money. So if I was supposed to close on January 1st and have that $500,000 in my hand, but I really don't close on the replacement contract until April 1st. I've lost the use of that $500,000 for those 4 months. I've been damaged to that extent, so I'm entitled to compensation for that. So I have a lower purchase price, I've lost the use of the money, and I've had costs that were attended in ultimately affecting collection, me, among other things. So you've got a lot of things that are building up. And again, I would not want to be in your shoes if that suit came down, is that those things can add up. And there will be a question on your errors and omission coverage as to whether or not whether you got that coverage too. So for a lot of reasons, I think you need to really scrutinize the contracts as they're offered from the point of view of the person that you're representing. And if you're representing the seller, and I know there's a technicality as to who you're representing, but if you're representing the seller, and most of you do in listing situations, and you accept that one, watch out. One of the other things that I've seen a lot of lately, this is a direct result, I think, of the fevered pace that we had for the last 5 years, and these are title defects. Most of these things are coming up from unreleased liens, and I will tell you that there isn't a day that goes by that we don't have title reports with unreleased liens in there. And they fall in various categories. Some of them are pretty easy to address. If you've got a refi with Bank of America and they simply forgot to release the lien, that's pretty easy to address. If you have a sale, however, some years back, and it was funded by investor savings alone, we all remember those heydays, right? That bank is no longer in existence. You got some problems in getting that lien released because you have nobody on the other side to work with. Now, there's some statutory provisions, but they're very narrow and very difficult to meet. So you have that. And the biggest problem that we have is when you get private financing. And invariably, it seems that because there are attorneys involved when you create the loans, but there are no attorneys involved typically when the loans get paid off, because they'll be paid off a lot of times during the course, not in connection with a sale, but during the course of the private financing through a refinance with a commercial lender. And almost invariably, the private individuals, because there's no professionals involved at that point in the sense that a lot of times there's no realtors, there's no attorneys involved. So it'll be overlooked that, oh my gosh, yeah, here's the canceled note, but by the way, there's a lien on that property. People die, move, whatever, and then you got another problem. There have been recently as a national trend of various services that have started up to address this matter of these kinds of unreleased matters, and those are the simplest ones in the chain of title because they rarely involve litigation. Linda was kind enough to hand me an article out of Realtor magazine that talked about this at some length, and I actually got a charge out of this because it's written by a guy who owns one of these companies, and it's basically a self-promotion kind of situation. And he contradicts himself rather significantly in the article. He starts out quoting the American Land Title Association as saying that you got defects in about 25% of the properties. Actually, in 2000, it was 25. Now it's up to 36%. Those seem a little extreme to me. And then on the next page, he says about 45% of the time you have problems. So, you know, there's a sort of a blaring a clarion out there for you to use his company. Those are scare tactics because, quite frankly, I would say less than 10% of the time we actually see title defects. And most of those can be cured if they come to our attention earlier on because they're generally pretty benign kinds of situations. One of the problems we get, however, is that we, as the closing agent, haven't been given the contract in a timely manner, or having been given the contract in a timely manner, we have to wait for contingencies to be fulfilled before we pick up our obligations, order the title search, and take a look-see. Before I came into today, I was working with a client of mine who has just moved to North Carolina. And he's buying a condominium down there, a very expensive condominium, and was reviewing the contract. And in that contract, there is an obligation of the purchaser to order a title search immediately upon ratification of the contract so that while you're going through your banking process and the other contingencies that are there, we're also looking at this title contingency. The cost of doing a title search locally can be anywhere from $60 to maybe $100, $150, something like that. So it's not, it seems to me, much of an expenditure for the buyer to undertake this immediately upon ratification rather than waiting until all of the contingencies have been satisfied. And what you're doing, obviously, is if you wait, you're telescoping the process and you're asking for problems to occur at a bottleneck. So if you can, in the contracts, as you work with them and you draft your amendments and that sort of thing, you might keep that in mind and tweak the contract to say that something to the effect that once the contract is ratified by all parties, that the purchaser then is compelled to go ahead and order within 5 business days, whatever, and share the results of that title search promptly upon receipt. So we know that that title issue is either taken care of, or if it's not, it's going to require some effort. We have time to deal with that without impacting the closing. So I guess those are principally the two largest issues that I wanted to address as far as what I'm seeing out there. But one of the purposes of me being here today is also to respond to what you guys are seeing out there. So I'm going to open the floor up to Q&A. I got a bullseye on my chest here. Fire away, and I'll hear what you have to say and give you the best of my thoughts.
In your expert opinion, what percentage of the purchase price should be written in the contract as a deposit?
I'm sorry, in my opinion?
What percentage of the sales price should be written in as a deposit to protect the interest of the real estate?
Here's what I do. You got to kind of think, step back and take a look at the overall contract. You know what the purchase price is going to be. If there's a loan amount involved, you know then how much cash that the buyer is going to have to put up to the transaction. Ideally, I think you want to start at that point. How much of you guys will look at that and work off of that as being what reasonable amount we think. You want to have enough, obviously, so that if they bail, it's going to hurt them and it's going to assuage or soften the blow to the buyer. So if to the seller. So if there's no financing, I'm going to want more money. If there's then if there is financing, but I'm also going to want an amount that's going to make it hurt for the buyer to walk. So if that's a good lawyerly way of avoiding what kind of question that you have, what kind of percentages, I think you've got to look at that particular situation.
From the standpoint of the buyer now, reversing the situation, would that impact the realtor on the other side of the transaction as representing the buyer? Would they open themselves up to any action from the buyer?
Well,
in the case where the buyer wanted to walk?
Would it open it up to the buyer? I think if you've got a sufficient deposit, then that issue's off the table. No, if the buyer walks, he's going to risk it. And does it open it up to you getting a suit against the buyer? No, because I think you're being reasonable. I think it's unreasonable if you get a $500 from both points of view. If you get, you know, it's a negotiation.
What I mean is the buyer wants to make a $500 deposit.
Right.
You say, no, you need to make $8,000.
No, that's not the way it works. I think in that situation, you as the realtor have to take what your buyer wants to offer. You as the selling agent in that situation, or as the listing agent in that situation, should reject that offer. You ought to counter it. That's how the give and take would come. No, you've got to dance to the tune that your client calls. And when the buyer says, no, I don't want to offer that, you can't hold a gun to his head.
No. So you let the seller accept the offer if they want to, but you advise them.
You advise, that's absolutely right. I mean, ultimately, it's their decision. You're just the counselor. You got another question over here?
Yes, as a mortgage person, I see contracts, purchase contracts change and dates change a lot. What do you recommend for on or about closing as far as when you can change a contract before you actually have something in writing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We have these problems all the time, on or about. How do you deal with that? You got a half an hour? It's there for a reason, and the reason is because typically we don't want a harsh penalty for unforeseen events. If you've got a time is of the essence contract and it's going to close and the snowstorm arrives and you can't get there, in theory, and prices have gone up over the course of time, the seller can basically say, use that as an excuse to avoid the contract and extract more money out of the buyer. So we don't like situations like that to occur because they penalize people. And we want to keep people, try to deal with them at an arm's length in a fair manner. So, on or about is what we're doing, meaning that if you miss it by a couple of days, no harm, no foul. Well, that's not really the case because the seller might be wanting to buy a house, you know, in Colorado, and he's harmed. And by the way, his interest is continuing to, he has to pay on his loan every day that he's got that loan. So, the legal interpretation, and I've been looking for something to give a legal interpretation in case law on that thing for 35 years, and it's never been. And the reason, because it's generally not worth litigating. People just, the value isn't there. I have talked with judges, however, on the side and said, what do you think? And the last opinion, and the one that seems fairly consistent around here, is that on or about means that if you close within a month, then we're going to let it pass. If you're more than a month, however, we're going to charge you damages back to the date cited in the contract. Now, I don't know if that's going to stand judicial scrutiny, but that's what one judge told me that he would, how he would rule. You as a draftsman have a real difficult situation there, and you got to make sure that you understand what your client's needs are. Last thing, the reverse can also be the case. You get a JAG guy coming in here, and his classes are starting. He moves in the day before, wants to move in the day before classes start, and the seller doesn't get out of the house in time. You know, that's going to really cause a lot of hassle to him. He's got to get a room. He's got to move twice, all these kinds of issues, and he has no recourse on and on or about. So what you need to do is know what your client's needs are and then write it into the contract. On or about, just because it's printed on the form doesn't mean it's set in stone. Everything in that contract is negotiable. So if your guy's got to be in on a certain date, you build a penalty in. We're going to close by X date, and if we don't close by that date, then the party at fault is going to pay the other party or somehow compensate the other party for the damages incurred. So that is a relatively simple issue of communicating with your client. And it's something that I bet you most of the people in the room don't do because we're so accustomed to it. We've been using the same form for 30-some years, and it's had the same thing. And how many times? Once a year, it comes back and bites you guys, doesn't it? I mean, it's just there. It's something we don't. But that's critical, it seems to me, in counseling. If you're representing a purchaser, you got to counsel them, and from the seller's point of view, too, what that clause means. It's a good question. I don't know, how am I doing on time, Linda? Meaning I can take another question. All right. Got one over here. Big Bill.
Larry, one of the things that I've always been concerned about is, let's go back to the deposit. So the seller and the buyer are fighting over this $5,000 deposit. Can I take another offer? It looks like to me, until I get this thing resolved, I don't have a clear path to sell that property to anybody else. And that's been my biggest concern in the 35 years.
Another very good question. I trust you all heard that question, because we get into this real nebulous area, and that is where, let's say the buyers breach the contract and you're now representing the seller. And what does a realtor do with this piece of property out there? Well, first of all, you've gone to the lawyer, and the lawyer has said to the other side in a formal writing, saying, you're in breach of contract, and this is what we're going to do. So you lay out what you're going to do. And The party that is damaged has a legal obligation to mitigate the damages. You can't just sit back and let damages accrue and then willy-nilly go out and collect them. You have an affirmative obligation to take steps to minimize those damages against the breaching party. So you're going to put them on notice, you're going to remarket the property. When the contract comes in, you're going to put in that contract notification that there is a prior contract that is in breach, and you're going to give them 48, 72 hours, whatever, when the second contract comes in, and you just give them advance notice and let them continue to exacerbate that breach at every step of the way. That's the only thing you can do. The problem comes when, okay, we're now 4 months out, we got the second offer, and the first guy says, I want to buy it now. Then you got some interesting litigation. Because he's so far in breach, can he? And that's another case that I have not seen litigated. That I'm sooner or later it'll happen. But so the idea there is continuing notice and continuing breach. And as long as you let the other side know what you're doing, then they really can't use that at a later point to come back and bite you.
In some of the rural areas, we've had some issues with surveys. Have you run into any of those problems?
Keeps us in business. Yes, indeed. That's a dicey situation because the surveys are, you know, it goes back to the requirement of the lender. And the lender will require title insurance without exceptions to survey. And in the old days, they would require you to get a survey. The title company would, before they would delete that exception. Competition in that industry has gotten to a point where now you can typically find an old survey and get an affidavit, regardless of how old it is, and the title company will accept that risk for mortgagee title insurance only. They won't issue that owner's coverage. And the reason is because they're not exposing themselves to the full amount of the home. They're exposing themselves only to the amount of the mortgage. And if there is a defect in the problem, the owner is the one that suffers the first loss. So the title company is taking a risk, but it's a very minimal risk in their opinion. Well, it's continued to progress to now. There's a lot of situations where they won't require even an old survey. They'll just go ahead and issue the affirmative coverage. That's, as a result of the competition in that industry. Now, that's what was required, what's needed. From a buyer's point of view, that's something that you have to pay attention to and I think seek some legal advice in the situation. And I'll tell you, I had a lawsuit years ago where I represented a real estate agent who was over in Meadowbrook Drive, I think, went out in the backyard to a piece of property that he didn't list, he was selling. He was selling, working with a client, and they went out in the backyard and they found the irons to the property, and he's pointing out to the buyer, here's where your backyard is, that sort of situation. Excuse me. They went to closing, and after closing, people move in, and son's playing in the backyard, neighbor comes over and basically tells the kid to get off that's my yard, get. And when it turns out that it was. There was a misrepresentation. It was an innocent misrepresentation, but a misrepresentation by the realtor. And the buyer sued the realtor for that misrepresentation. Now, the realtor was found not liable. As a matter of fact, it didn't even go to the jury. And the reason was because
In the interim, the buyer, meaning in the interim after the contract was signed, the buyer went out and purchased a new survey of the property. In order for someone to be liable for damages, not only has there to be the reason that causes the damage, but there has to be reliance upon that. So if I make a mistake and you don't rely upon my mistake, I don't owe you. And that was the situation in this case where, an affirmative misrepresentation was made. Yeah, if they'd relied upon that, then there would have been damages, but they did not rely upon it because they got the intervening survey. It showed the defect in title, if you will. The poor attorney that was representing the buyer did not have evidence that the buyer had ever seen the survey. And the buyer, of course, said, oh, I've never seen it. Kind of hard to believe, but that put the attorney in a very difficult situation. This is why I have my clients sign the surveys when they sit in my desk so that can't happen. But long and short is that because the buyer did not rely upon the misrepresentation of the realtor, then the realtor was not liable. So two issues there. One, as a realtor, don't make any representations about whether the irons are, because you're not a professional surveyor. Dump that on somebody else. There's no reason for you to be accepting that kind of responsibility. And two, you need to, again, get some input. A survey is in Forest Lakes is different from a survey in Whitehall. Okay? So you kind of got to, again, look at the situation, discuss it with your client. You can also get quotes, find out, let them make the decision, but make sure it's an informed decision.
All right, this goes back to the deposit. Our VAR contracts do not limit the liability of the buyer to the deposit. I mean, if they walk away from a contract, then they're responsible for the full amount. Is your experience that they put down a larger deposit that they're less likely to walk away from a contract?
Yeah, absolutely. The question is depending upon the size of the deposit, is that inversely proportional to the buyer's desire to run? And yeah, the more money that they put up, the more likely they're going to stick the process out and not change their minds. We saw a phenomenon that moved in here from Northern Virginia, and they basically there was a group of people that was chasing Ryan Holmes around. And every time for about 7 or 8 years that Ryan went in and started a new project, the prices during construction would go up significantly. So this pack of people followed them around, and they were flipping homes. That's all they were doing. They never took ownership. Well, that worked fine up until about a year ago, or a little bit less. And that one right there constituted a huge portion of the 39% breach that NV Homes sustained. We had a little bit of that here. We didn't have it anywhere near the scale that they had it in Northern Virginia. We are, however, becoming more and more like that market. You can bet you that everything being cyclical, next time around, there's going to be more of that in this market. And you need to be aware of that. Just find out who your buyers are. You know, you're professionals, so go out, do your legwork, find out who your buyers are, and be careful in drafting your contracts. All right. I've taken up enough of your time. Again, it's been a real pleasure to be here. Hope to see you all soon.
Thank you, Larry, and thanks to the Education Committee for planning this great program for us. Now it's time to move on to committee reports, and our first report, our PAC has a presentation today. Pat Jensen, a broker with Real Estate 3 and also president-elect of VAR, is an RPAC trustee, and she is going to help with this presentation to talk to us about RPAC. Pat? I don't know if you all heard it, but my phone went off a little bit ago, and I feel very guilty. So I'm going to start off the RPAC with a $100 bill to Pat.
Good girl. We did not plan that. We didn't plan that. Can you hear me okay? But I'm going to call Art Pearson and thank him for trying to call you during the meeting. I would also like to say that in their infinite wisdom, I've moved on to this position right now of president-elect of the state, and they approached me prior to the meeting of the convention and suggested that they now feel that president-elects should always be state chairman of RPAC, and I'm going, I don't have much to do, sure. But this is a direction that we have put out to the whole state, and apparently this is being done on a national level. And so Judy Savage, as your president-elect, is the chairman for this year, I believe. Is that correct? And we have a wonderful committee that helps them out. But before I move too far into this, I do want to thank Arlene and Matt, if they're here. Arlene and Matt, would you two stand up? They just did a tremendous job last year helping us reach our goal, which we did, and we're all very excited. But before I go further, everybody that has on a sticker, stand up. Everybody that has on one of these stickers, stand up. And then anybody else who didn't get a sticker but have, in fact, donated for RPAC for this year, you can also stand up and get your sticker later. Everybody clap. Thank you so much. That is just great. I've got somebody's glasses up here. Are these yours? Okay, I'm sure I don't run off with them. We're already at the beginning of February and have collected $21,896 towards our 2007 fair share goal. And that has come from 469 of our members. Our 60% participation goal for members is 688. So we only have to get money from 219 people, and we will reach that same magic 60% that Matt and Arlene got last year that we sort of pulled off at the last minute. Because of all the stress we had doing this at the last minute, we'd like to hit this goal well before the end of the RPAC fundraising period. So every meeting will have the stickers, and if you have donated to RPAC for 2007, make sure you have your stickers. We will have places for you to sit up front, even though some of you I know like to sit in the back, you know, come on up front, it's okay. And so we want to list the people who are donating, just make it more obvious and get involved much earlier on in the program. So we need to raise 1,024 to reach our fair share. But our fair share is just a drop in the bucket. Is that right? We've already collected 21,896. Our fair share amount that we're sort of required as an association to bring in, and that's like the minimal standards, is 22,920. That's not our goal. That's the state fair share amount. And so we're only $1,000 away from that. So we're just going to get that taken care of and behind us. Let's see what else they have for us here. First, let me tell you a little bit about RPAC. RPAC is not about partisan politics, and it is not about personal issues. Far too often I hear people say, well, I'm not going to donate to RPAC because, daggone, if they didn't give money to so-and-so last year and he's in such-and-such a party and I don't believe it. Or we hear things like, well, I'm not going to give it because last year they gave it to the Republican and the Democrat, and that doesn't make a bit of sense. It is not partisan politics. It is about our real estate industry and making sure that we have a seat at the table to protect our business and the value of our clients' real estate property. RPAC is about fighting for health insurance. It's about ensuring that eminent domain legislation isn't allowed to rob our homeowners of their value of their property. It's political insurance. You could look at it that way for our business, and I thank every one of you who have invested in RPAC. This year is going to be a tremendous year. Every single seat is up for re-election this year. I, for the first time, was involved in the bill, what's it called, Benton? Bill review. Well, I didn't make it to the first meeting, so I got this lovely Dell computer box at my office, and I'm so excited. I thought, oh, goody, they're going to give President-elect their own little laptop. Well, I opened it, and it is a notebook that's that thick. And these people, who else in here does the review of the bills? Benton, do we have anybody else in here that does that? Bill May? I want to congratulate you. The work they do in reviewing every single bill to make sure that hidden somewhere in a bill there's not some issue that could affect your business or your client's value of their property is incredible. I take my hat off to them, and that is part of what we're doing. So think of it as an insurance policy. Now, we seem to have skipped a step. Isn't there a category between 100 and 250? So you get a pen up to $99, and then you don't get another pen to 250?
99 to 249.
Oh, okay. 99 to 249. I got it. Sorry about that. I should have realized that. Duh. The next level is the capital insider status, and these are people who contribute between 250 and 499. And I would like you to come forward, and Beth and Ken, y'all are coming up. You have the pens for Reeves, Bailey. Reeves, are you here? Beth, do you have their pens? Or Ken does? Reeves, Bailey. Andrea Gruber. Thank you, Andrea. Matt Hodges. Thank you, Matt. Greg Slater. Bill May. Peter Sherman. We thank you very much for your contributions. Next, we have our Sterling R. And this year, we had a good number of people contribute to Sterling R, and these are people who contribute between 1,000 and 2,500. Carol Clark, if you'll come forward, I have a pen to give you. Benton Downer, come forward. Percy Montague, are you here today? I believe, is Percy sailing already? Percy's in St. Lucia's, is it? Oh, my gosh. Pat Jensen and Drake Vandecastle. So if y'all come up, I have your pen. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So I want to thank you for your many years of service. Some of you that are contributing on that level will have a number of diamonds, and I'll get four diamonds in mine this year. So we thank you very much for contributing on that level of participation. Please notice the names of our RPAC investors. These are people who are putting their money where their mouth is, and they're standing up for our association and for their RPAC livelihood. So we want to thank each and every one of you, and thank you so much. You will be hearing a lot from me this year. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat. And now I think Benton Downer, legislative update. Benton will give us a legislative update today.
Good morning. I got 5 minutes. I could do this for 3 hours, and we still wouldn't be caught up. This is the Capital Insider. You all should be receiving that. That's the bills that we are tracking. Bills that we track fall into three categories: bills we oppose, bills that we support, and bills that we monitor. I'm not going to waste my time on bills that we're monitoring because most of them are going to die. I will talk to you about some things we support and oppose. I'm going to try to do it in 2 minutes, open the floor up for questions. The first bill is Senate Bill 1012, and it would require that any residential or commercial real estate development go through a state funding process that would require them to do a feasibility analysis study as to the impact of that development with regard to roads, schools, any adequate public facility. We obviously don't support that bill. Unfortunately, it has gotten some strong legs, and it's coming out of Senate unanimously supported. I think the last vote on it, was this the one that was 17 to 4? It was either 17 to 4 or 22 zip. So we are really getting nervous about it, but there's not a whole lot we can do. It's got a tremendous amount of support. Remember how this works. There'll be crossover the week after we're down there, and all these bills will go to each house. So we are already starting to work in the House to see if we can't work on getting this bill either redefined or moved away. House Bill 2011 is something that we've supported. It redoes the disclosure form. I think it will help us. I think it's a good bill. We have supported that bill. We continue to support it. I think it's got legs. It's going to get through. It's not a problem. House Bill 2064 is the educational regulation change bill that we championed at the state level. I can tell you it's moving pretty slowly. It's still in committee. I looked at it last night. They are going to work. I think they get another whack at it today if it gets out of there. So far, the only change is I think we had front-loaded the new agent's education requirements, and we were trying to get them done in a fairly short period of time. We got a lot of resistance to that. We extended it to 6 months. There's an addendum to this bill that extends it to 12 months. If they keep monkeying with it, it'll be back to where it was before we started at 24 months. So we are trying to hold the line at 12. House Bill 2841 is Delegate Hall's bill. He's been a good champion of the realtor positions, and this is a great bill, and it talks about there's a maximum of $5,000 per employee. This makes it sound like it's per government employee, but it's extended to state employees, school board employees, which are teachers, any public service employee, which would include firefighters and policemen. It enables us to raise our grant money from $5,000 to $15,000 per user, which is long overdue, and we actually put this bill forth 2 years ago, and it didn't pass. I think it'll pass this time. I don't think there's anything to worry about with that, and we wholeheartedly support it. House Bill 2314 is from one of the guys up in Northern Virginia, and that is going to provide for imposition and collection of tolls for use of certain interstate highway system components in the state of Virginia. I think you'd have to be living under a rock not to recognize the fact that this session is all about transportation. And a lot of the stuff that we were worried about, like tax increases and things like that, you're not going to see because they are trying to do something to fix the transportation issue. This is actually a good bill. We have a monitor on it, but quietly we support it. It would enable localities to possibly put toll roads on the major interstates 64, 81, 95. There are 3,150 active bills in the legislature at this point in time. I would say of those bills, maybe less than half directly impact our industry. So our monitoring position now is based on roughly about 1,500 bills, most of which we are supportive of. The ones that we oppose, most of them have died. They die in a committee or they just get pulled. So the good news is many of these bills appear on an annual basis. Again, it's an election year. You're probably not going to see a tax increase. They do want to try to fix transportation. I will warn you, there are some transportation bills out there. There's a website. Is Jim Duncan here? There's a website out there called Richmond Sunlight. That's what I'm on now. And it is a wonderful website. It's richmondsunlight.com, and it tracks every single bill. It tells you exactly where it is. You need to go to that site and look at the transportation package because it is all-encompassing and big. And let me give you an example of something that's been trotted out that's got some legs that we don't support and we can't do anything about. In Northern Virginia, they are going to produce a grantor's tax, which we have historically opposed. Northern Virginia Association of Realtors has recently come out in support of it, and it is going to tax only the commercial and multifamily section of the economy. In other words, if there's a commercial transaction, they will pay a different level of fee from the residential transaction, and they will pour that money into a fund. Let me backtrack a minute. The reason we are supporting the transportation bill, one of the transportation bills that's up there, is because we're going to set up it's Normant, and it's a Senate Joint Bill 373. Senator Normant has put this forward, and it is a constitutional amendment to set up a transportation fund that cannot be rated. And if it is rated by the general fund, they would have to pay it interest, and they would have to guarantee to pay it back within 48 months. And these are two things that we added to the bill because we don't want transportation funds intermingled with the general fund. So with that, and again, I could talk to you about this for an hour. There's a lot of stuff out there. And what I'd love to do is just ask you if you have any questions or concerns or if there's anything that I can answer just while I'm here. Awesome. That means I did a decent job.
The $250 million that is in the current package that's being proposed to take from the general fund, there's concern that $250 million that's taken each year from the general fund would impact services such as get into education, mental health, and so forth. Has VIR taken any position or any thoughts on that? There is, seems to be some concern about that amount of money each year coming from the general fund into transportation.
The way it is a one, it is a $1.25 billion trust fund. Of that money, $250 million would come from the general fund, of which there is currently a surplus. So we have the money to fix some of the transportation problem, but not all of it. The other funding sources would be dedicated funds. Again, you need to understand, there is no legislation in place. If we set up a trust, if we set up a transportation fund right now, that money that pours into that $1.25 billion that pours into that fund is good for this calendar year only. Next year, they can move all of that money to other uses. So if we have to do a constitutional amendment to make that fund pure so that you can't rob it. But we are running a surplus. If you talk to Rob Bell, he thinks we can fix transportation primarily through existing revenues. There's a tremendous amount of pork spending at the state level as there is at the federal level. The VDOT, you know, we don't get much federal funds anymore for VDOT, but it's all run by the state. It's very territorial. We went through this huge thing to close a bunch of VDOT shops at the end of the day. I think they closed 8. Because everybody raised Cain about it. So, but don't worry about the funding mechanism that we need to focus on for the transportation are things that directly impact our industry. And we want to negotiate with them to get it done right, but we don't want to be the reason that this thing gets funded. And by that I mean we're not going to double our grantors tax so they can raise 3/4 of the fund out of one source of revenue. It's just not fair. Did I answer your question? Yes.
Ben, what's happening with eminent domain?
It's one of the things that got swept under the rug this year because there's some bills out there on it, but none of them are going to get anywhere. I mean, again, the question was what there are always a number of bills on eminent domain, and most of them are getting lost in committees or shelved, or you know, a lot of that stuff's not even getting out of anywhere. I mean, again, the focus is that's not where the focus is. It's an election year. All these guys are up for election, and they are working very hard to solve the transportation issue because they want to get reelected. And that's why it's really important that you all give money to RPAC this year, because we can have an impact in these people's pocketbooks, and that's where they need to be. Again, Richmond, so go to Richmond Sunlight. You can see how much money they have, cash they have on hand. Rob Bell's got $110,000 because he's loading the guns because he knows he's going to get somebody to run against him. Thank you.
Thank you, Benton. See, I think we have a report from the Community Relations Committee today. Gracie, Susan, they're going to tell us about, they've had some good meetings already and have some great initiatives for 2007, so they will give us what's going to be happening with them in 2007.
Hello, I'm Gracie, and I'm the chair of this year's Community Relations Committee. This is Susan McGinnis, and she's the vice chair. We have had great meetings. Our committee filled up almost immediately, but we still have a lot of room for volunteers. That means everybody here, so we'll be calling on you all year, and because that's what our committee does. We have 5 initiatives that we've established for this year, and our first one is working with Habitat for Humanity to partner with family advocates. We did this last year, and that is you're using your expertise to help the partners that are partnering to receive the homes to actually go through the buying process. And so that's a really good thing. We'll be calling on you all to do that. And that's an ongoing thing. We've tried to spread these out throughout the year so they're all not just in the summer or just in the fall or spring when we're busy. We're going to do the food drive again. We had a lot of visibility with that last year with pods, with Barclay bringing the pods in for our food drive. We want to do that in March, so that's our only spring thing because obviously that's our busy time. We'll do Fridays after 5. We're trying to do it just twice this year so that we can just inundate the place with our green shirts and just have the whole thing. Andrea's working on that to see if we can just be the only ones for two nights, one at the beginning of the summer and one at the end of the summer. So when we're there, we're there, and everybody will see us. We'd like to help with the race that Shelter for Help in Emergency does in the fall. So that'll be our fall initiative. And we'd like to help with the Toy Lift volunteerism because they already have a lot of publicity. So we'd like to latch onto that and help out with that. And that, of course, is in December. So that spreads all our initiatives out through the year. And so we'll be calling on you. And so when you see the emails, especially the panicked ones, please respond. Help us.
Thank you. I think they have some great initiatives, and I know some of these, particularly I think the Fridays After Five may take a lot of help if we're going to try to staff every booth or every vendor that night. We'll probably take a lot of people. I just want to put in a plug for Habitat. I am an advocate for a Habitat family, and it is a wonderful thing to do and doesn't really take a lot of your time, but you get a good relationship with one of the families that's building a home through Habitat, and it's very worth your time. So when the call goes out for that, I understand they need about 15 more advocates, so think seriously about helping with that. Do we have any other committee reports?
Chris Allerton with Real Estate Weekly. Just two quick invitations. One is on the back of the agenda, and that is to the Real Estate Weekly 15th anniversary party, which is Tuesday from 4 to 6 at the Carr offices. So those of you who are going to Realtor Day on the Hill, stop by before you leave. If you're leaving on the 6th, come by. We're having a drawing for two $25 gas cards. Maybe you can use those to fill the tank, go to Richmond, that kind of thing. Second thing is, you'll see this in the news group, a survey to get your input on the new Real Estate Weekly website. We're developing a new website, so here's your opportunity to give your input on what you'd like to see in that. So watch the, it's in this week's news group, it'll be in next week as well. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Are there any other committee reports today? Matt. Look forward to seeing you next week at Day on the Hill. The meeting is adjourned.